Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to Lee and the IC. My name is Alex Newman, an associate editor at the Investors Chronicle, and I'm once again very pleased to be here in the FT studios for the fourth and final conversation of 2023 with Lord John Lee. As regular listeners will be aware, everything we talk about on this podcast is filtered through the thoughts, actions, feelings, and experience of one of the most seasoned personal investors in the country. That necessitates the disclaimer that though we will be talking about individual stocks and John's portfolio in detail, this podcast is purely for educational purposes, and nothing in it should be taken as financial advice or recommendations to buy or sell shares. This month, we're going to mix things up a little bit. Instead of a deep dive on one company, we're going to conduct a mini end-of-year audit on five smaller holdings in John's portfolio before getting his thoughts on the market as we enter 2024. Talking about a novel idea for using shares to encourage financial literacy in schools, and how you might want to broach the topic of investing around the Christmas table. Anyway, let's get to it. John, very warm welcome to you today. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
So as mentioned, this is going to be a bit more of a quick fire round on some of your smaller holdings, what they do, how you came to be invested, and how they've performed over the past year, and your current position and thoughts. So I wanted to start with, I think, one of your smaller holdings. That's the litigation financing firm
Manolete.
Yeah, I always used to call them Manolete, but Manolete. So they listed at the end of 2018 at 200p on a wave of interest in their market for litigation funding, now trading at just under 160p. What's the story here vis-a-vis your holding?
Well, the story is that they had a very, very difficult time during COVID. Because if you recall, the government effectively prevented companies being put into liquidation or similar, and therefore it was a pretty lean time for Manolete. But I bought them on the anticipation that clearly there would be, regrettably, but nevertheless this is realistic, a build up of insolvencies post COVID. You know, this is turning out to be the case, sadly, in many ways. But of course, Manolete do perform a very useful public function in chasing directors and others who misappropriated corporate funds. So they've seen a significant pickup in business. Mainly, they tell me of on smaller claims. Rather than some of the larger situations, but they say that is the normal pattern, that the smaller companies tend to tip over first, and then some of the larger companies hang on for rather longer. So they're anticipating quite a significant increase in activity. Indeed, they're already seeing it, but as I say, with the smaller companies, and they've increased their legal staff to handle. And then, of course, they've also recently been involved in a pilot scheme for Barclays, I think it was, and that apparently has been successful. So everything is going in the right direction, apart from the dear share price, right, which has sagged somewhat. So obviously, it's a smaller holding of mine, somewhat more speculative than holdings that I normally have. But, I am anticipating over the next 12 months a useful recovery in the share price. And indeed, it's one of the three stocks that I've selected, one of the competitions that I participate in with investing friends that will perform the best in 2024.
Yeah. Just a bit more clarity on the funding they do. Who is it that they provide funding for, and
they don't provide funding. What actually happens is, as I understand it, that the administrator of a company or the liquidator calls in a company like Manolete. When I say like Manolete, there aren't many others. Mm. It's pretty unique. And they then use their skills to get money back from directors and others who've misappropriated funds.
Right.
So they don't provide any money themselves, although they do buy cases, as it were, for apparently fairly small amounts of money.
Okay. One of the questions around, I suppose, modelling legal assets is that it can be a little hard to do. You've got judgment calls on recoveries, etc. I suppose they're public track record is still fairly limited, and we've had this sort of blunted cycle, as you said. What's your feeling on you know, this slightly novel asset class?
Well, I mean, clearly they do fulfil a significant function in chasing those who've behaved improperly and badly. So I think that I hope that when the bottom line begins to improve, and I hope it improves significantly, then I think, you know, the shares hopefully will rise, and you know, their rating will improve, and the awareness of the company, I think, will increase as well, which is important.
And just finally, I mean, you know, this is in some ways a hedged play on the UK economy, because it's you know, when Man Elite succeeds, it's not necessarily because the economy is doing incredibly well. Should we read into this that your sort of view of the UK economy is maybe sort of softening?
It's cautious. No, far from that. I mean, one of the features that I've been very conscious of recently is you know, of the quality of the results of most companies that I'm invested in. Quite frankly, the results are pretty good, and you know, those who were really forecasting doom and gloom, I think, have been proven to be totally wrong. But inevitably, there always will be business failures and insolvencies. And of course, we've had this pent-up situation because of insolvencies being banned during COVID. And of course, once again, the rise in interest rates clearly will have pushed a number of companies over the cliff.
Mm. I suppose there's an important distinction, isn't there, that the UK economy is not the same thing as the average listed stock market company, which tend to be slightly larger than the firms, I suppose, Man Elite are dealing with. One of those larger companies which has been having a good year is Hollywood Bowl. I mean, as a business, I suspect less introduction needed here. They run a bowling alleys around the country under the Hollywood Bowl brand. When did you first invest, John? Are you a keen bowler yourself?
No, I think I may have bowled once in my life years ago when I was younger. But I have been conscious of them as a quality smaller cap stock, and took advantage of the lowish price and the attractive yield. I think they were yielding, you know, 4.5% towards 5%. And I had the opportunity of meeting Stephen Burns, the chief executive, and talking to him about the business. And I formed the view that they were extremely well managed, very tightly managed, expanding in this country and expanding in Canada. As well. So I was happy to come aboard. And of course, more recently, they've had good results and the future looked quite rosy, both here and in Canada. And of course, their rival, their main rival, I think it was called Ten Entertainment?
Yeah.
Has been subject of a takeover bid from the US. So that obviously has highlighted the attraction of bowling, because you know, it's a very cash generative business, and actually there are relatively few leisure quoted businesses, leisure operated businesses that one can invest in, and I felt very comfortable with investing in Hollywood Bowl, and you know, it's checking up quite nicely.
Yeah, I suppose like Man Elite, a bit of a casualty of the pandemic as well. I mean, they, as a leisure company, they weren't able to function really for quite a lot of, if we're looking back a couple of years now. That Ten Entertainment deal, very interesting for such a close peer. It looks like that was struck at about 12 times forward earnings, something like a 30-odd% premium to the share price. Do you think that looked overly cheap?
I think it's a little bit on the cheap side.
Yeah.
But then I don't know the business like I know Hollywood, as it were. So I don't know, you know, how well run it is. I don't know much about it, to be quite honest. I opted for Hollywood Bowl, which I think is a quality operation.
Yeah.
So we will see. So it's a useful holding of mine. It's not one of my largest ones or larger ones. But it's a useful holding, and you know, I'm very happy to stay with it.
Yeah. So yeah, and shares up nearing that that pre-COVID peak now. So thirdly, I think it's fair to say, you know, one of the bigger disappointments in the UK market, not just in your portfolio over the past decade, PZ Cousins, the maker of hygiene, baby, and beauty products, probably best known for Carex. So I'm right in thinking this is a fairly long-term holding of yours?
It's a long-term holding because I've got strong historical links with them. I think I'm still showing a profit on my shares, even though the capitalization has come down by about two-thirds over the last few years, from a peak of about 1.8 billion to about 600 million today. And I was on the board for 10 years, many years ago, and I was involved in the takeover by PZ, Paterson & Co., as it was then, of Cussons. And of course, they were both Manchester-based company, which was my home base. So I have a historical involvement and awareness of them, and considerable affection for them. You know, a fine Manchester company, one of the biggest quoted PLCs, certainly was in and on Manchester, a big supporter of the Commonwealth Games. In fact, I've still got a very substantial Imperial Leather, one of the Cussons products, Imperial Leather Commonwealth Games umbrella from those Commonwealth Games, and it's still very functional, it reminds me all the time of my time with PZ. But from an investing point of view, they have been very, very disappointing. And I've written relatively recently in the Financial Times, drawing attention to what I believe to be the significant gap between the worth of the brands of the business and the overall capitalization of the company. I mean, obviously, they've had a very difficult time over the years with Nigeria, which has been a difficult market, but a very big market for PZ. And of course, we're talking about a company that come 2050 will be the third most populous country in the world. So, you know, it's a huge economy and a huge market, and PZ are well positioned there with their brands, having been there over 100 years, probably the largest, if not one of the largest employers in manufacturing in Nigeria. But the business has been poorly managed in recent years. There have been failures of acquisitions, and I think it's probably also suffered because of family control. I think that have been snapped up by now. By one of the bigger people in that sector, because some very big people in that sector, had the business not been controlled by family. I think that control now is beginning to drift apart, with trusts and senior members of the family not really being in the business now. So we'll see what happens. But the brands are significant, including Carex, which you mentioned, Imperial Leather, Morning Fresh, and Sanctuary Spa. The business, of course, in very big business in Nigeria, I think is very valuable, even though obviously there are problems with it. I've got a big business in baby products in Indonesia. Once again, a huge growing market, and a significant business in Australia. And if you add up all the parts and all the brands, and brands do fetch big money, as we saw when Mars paid 170% premium for Hotel Chocolat. More of that later, perhaps. you can see the value in brands. So I think PZ is a very interesting situation, with no real downside that I can see, and the new chief executive is thinking bringing considerable improvements to the business, and there is a greater focus now. So one way or another, I think value will begin to come through in PZ over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and it's an interesting case, because I suppose the Nigeria division, while a potential source of huge optimism, which you alluded to, I suppose has also been seen as a bit of a millstone around their neck for the last few years, because there's obviously lots of issues with Nigeria's economy and the local currency and how that translates into a multinationals. Group earnings. I just wanted to pick up though on a point you mentioned about your sentimental attachment to this company, which not wanting to in any way sort of question that sentiment, but I suppose when it comes to investing, is that not sometimes an issue to have be sort of emotionally invested in the stakes for a company?
I think it is, I suppose one criticism of my investing would be that I tend to be a little bit too loyal to companies that I get close to, because I do take an interest in the businesses. I do try and establish a relationship with the key people in the business who are running it. I'm not a remote investor, as it were, who just ignores the business and the employees and I'm frankly proud of many of the businesses that I invest in. And, you know, PZ is a very good company, and their products are good, and they support directly and indirectly a lot of charities, both in the UK and in Nigeria. And of course, the other point is that because my shareholding is historic and was bought many, many years ago, I'm still sitting on a profit. So were I to realise, it's not in my ISA, were I to realise there would be capital gains tax to pay. So that's another consideration in terms of moving out. But, you know, as I say, at the moment, I think the shares are good value. So it's a useful holding of mine, medium-sized, I would say. So we're just watching and waiting.
Yeah, and I suppose it underlines the point that, you know, whatever's happened to the share price, it's still the valuation that you have to reappraise continually, you know, looking forward. The fourth stock I wanted to touch on, FW Thorpe, another homegrown UK company with a growing global footprint. I mean, they look to be in slightly better shape. So it's a designer and manufacturer of professional lighting, which now makes about half its sales outside the UK. What lit up your investment imagination with this?
Company, I like the lit up. Yes, well done. Well done. It ticked all the boxes many years ago when I first invested in it. Once again, it was a family control. I think it still is pretty well a family controlled
the Thorpe name.
Business. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I did visit it years ago in Redditch, I think it was based. Or is based, and it was conservatively managed, which is what I like to see. There was a strong sort of proprietorial presence there, and it had a lot of cash. It's always been very conservative, and still has a big positive cash position, which I like to see, rather than debt, quite obviously. And over the years, it has grown and has paid increasing dividends and special dividends, and it's turned out to be over the years a very successful investment. But in more recent years, the share price, you know, has been somewhat flat. I think it's pretty fully valued at the moment, but a very, very solid business. But once again, not dissimilar from PZ in that it's a historic holding of mine. And if I were to dispose of it, once again, CGT would come into play.
Yeah.
It's also, of course, I think I'm right in saying quoted on AIM as well, which carries inheritance tax advantages. And when you're in the 80s, as I am, that's something you do take into account.
Yeah. We did have a question from a listener, Vincent, on this company, who maybe is looking at things in slightly more risk-based terms. His question was, is the company undervalued, or is this transition to LED lighting a threat to the business because of the replacement life cycle of, you know, lot longer-lasting lights? I suppose that's a consideration for every product manufacturer. It's like, if you're making too good a product, that can sometimes be a bit of an issue.
The answer is, it's a fair question, and I don't fully know the answer because I'm not that close to Thorpe's, but you know, maybe I should make contact with them again and reestablish relationships. So I couldn't really answer. All I would say is that yes, there is clearly a replacement aspect of new LED, but at the same time, you know, because of the quality of their lighting and products, they're involved in many of the new sort of infrastructure developments, and so, you know, we get a Labour government next time committed to major infrastructure spend. Obviously, there'll be lighting involved, and I would imagine Thorpe's will be benefiting from that. And of course, they've pushed, as you rightly say, globally now. It is a global business. I think they're into Holland in quite a big way. And so the product challenges are obviously something that all boards and managements do face. And all I would say is that you can only judge the quality of management by its track record. You know, what it's done rather than what it says it's going to do. And, you know, their track record is very good and solid. So I would back them to know what they're doing with their products and focusing on growth areas.
I mean, certainly what we can say about this business is that energy efficiency is a mega trend. That's not going away. So however they've considered strategically addressing their end markets, they do have a tailwind at their backs, don't they?
Correct.
So finally, a company I think we've briefly touched on before in the podcast is Goodwins. They had results out this week, or as you may be listening to it last week. But before we get onto that, could we just recap on what Goodwins do and you know why it's a company you're excited about or have been for a long time.
Very excited about it and impressed with it. And I visited it with a group of investors mid-year. It's a company I've been very slow to become aware of. But then they do, as a company, hide their light under a little bit of a bushel. They're very conservative and family controlled, based in the Potteries. But when I visited, I was hugely impressed with the commitment of the current generation. It's probably a third or fourth generation business, and there are three or four members, young members, cousins who now, of the founders and similar, who are running the business of the different divisions. And, you know, they're all hugely motivated with the business and their ambitions to take it forward and build on the legacy that they've inherited. Some of the products that they've got are really very exciting, like, for example, one that they think has got huge potential, which is a fire extinguisher, a lithium fire extinguisher for extinguishing lithium fires, which they've just produced and patented, and they believe it's got huge potential worldwide, particularly in the USA. So they've got a number of very interesting divisions. They produce powders for jewellery, submersible pumps. They produce radar, sort of lightweight radar for developing countries, which they think has got significant potential. And also, of course, their basic business with a very heavy sort of, castings and refractory ability produces some major steel castings for our submarine program and for the US submarine program as well. They're very significant suppliers, and so they'll benefit from the increased spend on submarines, and also, of course, very likely to benefit from the new AUKUS deal with Australia. So big potential there, and they've also developed quite a lot of money into a new product called Develco, which is supposed to be a very, very high temperature polymer. Apparently, there's only one other company in the world that is capable of doing what they believe they can do. So many attractive strands to this business that I see a surge in revenues and a surge in profits over the next few years. And of course, it is increasingly noticed now as a PLC, and the valuation has risen. But it's a very solid one to tuck away, I think, for the medium to long term.
I suppose the comparison with PZ Cousins, these aren't brands they're managing, but there's lots of product lines, aren't there, that they're... And you know, it sounds like, you know, quite a few more sectors in addition to the ones that PZ are facing. Where do you get this confidence from, though, that they don't just have a kind of grab bag of different technologies and products that in markets which sometimes are doing well, sometimes it's a little bit shakier, and that actually it amounts to one collective big... growth story? What do you get a sense of how they go after their markets and
I think the answer is overall. I would say the quality of the management.
Okay,
and that historically has been the comparison with PZs. I think they've thought through which areas they should be in. They were originally, I think, quite heavily involved in oil and gas. Mm. And then, of course, there was quite a big downturn there. So I think they thought about the areas that really did offer considerable scope, given their expertise. And so, you know, the submarine side, the huge sort of lead boxes that they provide for Sellafield, for nuclear waste, quite a significant contract there. Their focus on producing a fire extinguisher for lithium fires. All this, you know, demonstrates to me, you know, a very considerable focus on looking ahead to growth areas and growth opportunities. And I think that does mark them out.
Yeah. I always think with engineering companies, I will never claim to always understand the niches that they might be in. But, you know, the idea of an engineer running a business, there's something definitely attractive about that, isn't there? Because, you know, these are people whose job it is to find solutions to real tangible problems in the world. It's not just a case of thinking of a product to sell to a consumer. These are solutions that someone is in need.
Someone is in need. I mean, these are serious products, and of course, it's a serious employer in the potteries.
Yeah.
And also, they have a big apprentice intake as well. So, I mean, it's a very important company. But I think in terms of what you're alluding to, I think it was one of the Rothschilds who some years ago said that there are three ways of losing money: wine, women, and engineering.
Oh, right.
That the first two are the most enjoyable, the last one is the most certain.
Okay.
But I think Goodwin has really proven that wrong, as it were. They do make money out of engineering.
Yeah, there is an adage to the contrary for every bit of wisdom out there. So, I mean, the broader backdrop to all of this is that, you know, in the UK, I think we can say now rates are looking like they've peaked, if not yet about to fall. And it doesn't look like, though, you know, opinions on this vary, a severe recession is necessarily coming. We've also had a spree of takeovers for sort of sub £500 million companies. And I think you mentioned, you know, you've seen some signs that there are smaller fund managers with overhangs kind of clearing their positions after a rough couple of years, and that some overhangs might have dissipated. Particularly for, you know, sort of smaller companies that we've been discussing, does this... Do you think we're at the it's a tough call, isn't it? But we're kind of at the bottom. We're at the bottom of pessimistic sentiment, and that things, there's a bit more reason for festive cheer.
Well, I think the small caps particularly have been undervalued for quite a time, and I've always believed that value comes through in the end. One doesn't know what's going to, you know, trigger a rise, but value always comes through in the end, whether it's through a takeover or an upward re-rating. I was speaking at a Mellow event for investors about a month or so ago, and the title of my talk then was, quote, "A Great Time to Buy." I was encouraging people both to invest in the, you know, the bigger high yielding stocks like, you know, the Avivas and the M&Gs and Legal & Generals, 8% plus yields, and also drawing attention to the undervaluation of many of our quality small cap stocks. And I think what we've seen over the last 2 or 3 weeks is a fulfillment of that prediction, in a way that prices have moved forward, not quite across the board, but certainly in the majority of cases, quite usefully. I think over the last couple of weeks, I've not worked it out exactly, but I think my ISA is probably up about 5%. And we've seen some quite useful bounces in stocks going up, small cap stocks going up sort of, you know, 7 or 8, 9%. In a day, really, when selling overhangs are dealt with, as it were, or a little bit of positive buying coming in. So I think there's a great danger in investors just sitting on cash, and they're going to miss the boat, in my view. They've, I think, already missed the first boat that's departed. Not too late to buy, certainly not. But those who are sitting on a lot of cash and are rather cautious and think they're being clever, getting 5% or whatever it is on cash, that is fine. But the question they must ask themselves is, how long is that going to last? You know, another 6-9 months maybe. Whereas, you know, if you've invested in some of the high yielding stocks, good solid companies that really shouldn't reduce dividends, if anything, hopefully roll them steadily forward, you know, that's where you should be aboard. My broad message, you know, is very much, you know, to invest and take the long view, not looking for any, you know, any short term advantage, but, you know, getting into good companies at sensible levels.
You've obviously have a lot on your plate in terms of following the companies you already have in your ISA and in your portfolio, John. I mean, that said, are the companies you're looking at right now, given the value out there, and I suppose the bounty of some of your larger dividend-paying stocks coming?
One is always looking for new opportunities, but as a generalisation, my approach has been very much to build up the size of holdings in companies that I already feel confident in, and take the long view. And I acknowledge what I said a little bit earlier, that sometimes I'm a little bit too patient, a little bit too loyal maybe, but, you know, there we are. That is my conservative small C makeup and approach. Many of the small ones that I'm in have been, you know, pretty flat. And of course, some of them, like companies like Treat and Ampario, have been very great companies, but have been substantially derated over the last couple of years. I never expected to see the value of Treat come down by 2/3, you know, when the company actually has performed pretty well and is still producing an attractive level of profits and has invested a lot in new plant. But I think it will rise again. But probably from being somewhat overvalued a few years ago, maybe some of these stocks are a little bit undervalued now.
So, John, since we last spoke on this podcast, you've been campaigning in both Parliament and beyond for an idea you've suggested might help to improve financial literacy or numeracy in schools through shareholder ownership. Can you, for those listeners who might not have picked up on the idea so far, can you just briefly outline it, its background and the feedback you've had
very,
since?
Very happy to do that. Yes, very conscious of the statement in... or the commentary in the Chancellor's autumn statement about the future of the government's 38-39% holding in NatWest Bank and the intention, or the possible intention, to dispose maybe via a sort of the TelSID type route involving the people out in the country, rather than the lines of the earlier privatisations of the Thatcher government that I was a little bit involved in when I was involved there as a member of Parliament. Conscious as I am, and I think we all are, of the near zero, people think I'm exaggerating, but I think it's probably true, the near zero of financial education that exists in most of our schools, it seemed to me that an interesting idea might be to try and somehow involve schools, particularly the state secondary schools, in that further disposal of NatWest shares. So I came up with the idea of the government gifting, say, £5,000 worth of NatWest shares in the disposal to each of the secondary, or offering them to each of the secondary schools in the country. And we have about 4,400 of those. So the total cost, if every school, every secondary school said, yes, I'd like my £5,000 worth of NatWest shares for free as a gift, that would cost the state £22 million, which is frankly a drop in the ocean. Now, I believe that gifting the schools and involving the pupils would actually really begin to be transformational and on the first step to really increasing awareness and interest, because that £5,000 would produce a dividend of about £350. And my idea would be that the pupils themselves in those secondary schools would decide how that £350 is spent, and they would vote. Maybe the senior classes would, so they could decide to buy an item for the school laboratory or the gym, or subsidise a trip from somewhere, a museum or whatever, or a camping trip, or maybe spend the money on supporting a local charity, a local food bank, whatever it is. But the point is, the pupils themselves would take that decision. Obviously, the teachers would structure the vote, as it were, and draw attention of the pupils to the options. But the pupils would decide. So, for the first time, and then also parallel to that, because the school owns the shares, the pupils could then participate digitally in the NatWest AGM, as an example. And I would hope that NatWest, you know, might send in some of their managers and similar and staff to give talks on financial education. So really, through this very modest amount of money in state terms, in national terms, £22 million, you know, one could really begin to teach and encourage youngsters to become aware of how banks operate, how the stock market to an extent operates, what a dividend is. I think a little bit of thinking outside the box, you know, could produce substantial dividends for the pupils themselves, maybe for some of the teachers who perhaps may be lacking a little bit of financial knowledge themselves, and also benefit the state. And I have to say that everyone that I've mentioned the idea to, both inside Westminster and outside, and indeed the reaction I've had from one or two public companies where I've suggested they might give some of the free shares to, say, secondary schools in their locality, has received a positive response. And my plan in the new year is to make a serious approach to the Chancellor, really led by a number of, hopefully a number of Conservative peers, former Cabinet Ministers, who are equally enthused with the idea. And I've already written to Howard Davis as Chairman of the NatWest Bank to get his reaction. Obviously, I didn't expect, and it's impossible for him to say, you know, what a great idea, as it were, but I would certainly say that he didn't close the door and really said it's very much up to the Treasury and, you know, encouraged me to talk to the Treasury about it. So all to play for in the new year.
Yeah, really, really looking forward to following this story and see how those next steps pan out, John. Just finally, I mean, regarding engagement and financial literacy, while we're on the topic, I just wanted to conclude by talking a bit about Christmas, about the festive season. I mean, for many, this is a time spent with family, also for reflection. I mean, personal finance and investing might not always feel like a festive subject, but you know, given listeners are thinking about their finances and investing, and we often reflect and look forward to a new year, is this a time to start a conversation? And if so, what are the important points to discuss, you know, when we're spending time with our families potentially in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think obviously the Christmas break gives people time to reflect, as it were, and to maybe look at their overall financial position and budgets for next year and savings and holiday plans and that type of thing. But also, I would suggest that they, you know, should begin to think also about maybe those who are interested in investing and believe in investing in the stock market and, you know, have some funds to invest, thinking about empowering the next generation. For the years, in my case, I built up portfolios for both my daughters, which they're very appreciative of, but I've never really managed to engender a great deal of interest from them. So I started a couple of years ago to adopt a rather different tack with two of my four grandchildren. Then I think nine and six, nine and seven, and I created a junior ISA for each of them, putting £5,000. Into a junior ISA. You can't do it directly as a grandparent, heaven knows why, but you're not allowed to do it. You have to do it through their parent.
I've noticed this recently as well.
You know, yeah. It's crazy. So then I discussed with them the sort of shares we should buy. And what I focused on was investing for them in a number of companies that they could identify and relate to, like, for the sake of argument, you know, Hollywood Bowl, like Greggs, like the supermarkets, and Marks and Spencer, Bloomsbury Publishing, who published the Harry Potter books, for example. So 10 or 12 companies, I think we had 10 of £500 each. Hotel Chocolat was one of them. Irrespective of the investment merits of those companies, they could understand that they own a very small slice of those businesses. And so I'm trying to educate them through that particular route. And we had a review some months ago of the first year. Overall, I think we made a slight profit and one or two disappointments. So actually, we made some changes and we decided we'd sell Hotel Chocolat, which had run into all sorts of trading problems. And then, of course, lo and behold, a few months later, along comes a bid from Mars at 170% premium to the prevailing price. So we got that wrong.
As one of our sell ideas this year, that was our shared pain, I think.
Right.
But we can console ourselves with chocolate, I suppose.
But interestingly, what the Hotel Chocolat bid, and it was at 170% premium on the prevailing price, was the value that Mars, rightly or wrongly, put on the brand Hotel Chocolat, which is known. So it comes back to the point I made earlier about with PZ, the value of brands and companies do pay a lot of money for established brands.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a way in through intangible assets, after all. I think there's lots to explore in our next conversation in January, which of course includes any questions you'd like to put to John. You can do that by emailing me at alex.newman@ft.com. Until then, all that's left for me to do is to wish you, dear listener, a happy Christmas, New Year and a successful 2024. And as ever, to thank you, John, for your thoughts.
Thank you very much indeed, and a happy Christmas to all those who listen, and successful investing.
Yes, indeed. And also to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe, for all her work behind the soundboard. Until next time, thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.